Microaggressions are a common occurrence that many people of color experience. How can mental health professionals broach these topics with clients in a way that fosters respect, growth, and development? And before we even consider helping our clients in this way, while recognizing our own personal journey, what are the internal and external cultural work that would enable us to be most effective? Welcome to People of Color in Psychology, the show that explores mental health topics specific to culture, diversity, and communities of color. I am your host, Jack Zinn. We have Dr. Lubna Samji as our guest today. Dr. Samji is an executive coach, consultant, a licensed psychologist, and the associate editor of the Consulting Psychology Journal. Additionally, Dr. Samji is sought out to speak to audiences about leadership, the workplace, diversity and inclusion, and psychology. Between her work and significant time volunteering, she has received numerous awards for her contributions to leadership, diversity, healthcare, and advocacy efforts. Dr. Samji was the recipient of the New York State Psychological Association's Distinguished Service Award, as well as the Excellence in Psychology Award by the Hudson Valley Psychological Association. As a South Asian Indo-Pakistani, Dr. Samji will be discussing the impact of microaggressions and steps to engage clients about these conversations, either in your clinical or consulting work. Dr. Samji, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Walk us through your journey, and can you tell me any memorable events and circumstances that influenced how you got into this work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, interestingly, my sort of origin story and my career journey have both been a bit circuitous. So I originally was born in Pakistan, and then my family moved to Bahrain. We then moved to Oman, then London, and then we landed in the United States. And I grew up in a predominantly white community and went to school in a predominantly white, you know, school. And from the get-go, got the sense that, you know, I was treated differently than a lot of my peers, by my peers, you know, by teachers. And certainly my parents were impacted as well by racism, whether it was vandalism to our house with hate speech associated with it, or just them being made fun of because of their accents and
oh my
things
gosh.
Like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Vandalism on your property?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh my gosh.
That was something. Yeah. So that was always in the background, those instances, and I think really shaped my work. And then fast forward to college, I was actually pre-law. I loved the law, and there were attorneys and judges in my family. And I would say probably the end of my junior year, I realized that as much as I loved the law, I really loved psychology. And I was stuck as to what to do because, like a lot of people in the community I grew up with, South Asian community, there was the expectation you'd be an attorney or a physician or an engineer. And psychology wasn't quite on that list. So I tried to grapple with that question, and I ended up actually going to someone who was a resource for students to help talk through those kinds of career questions. And I was lucky because it was someone who's uniquely poised, who understood the rigors of law school, but also understood the rigors of psychology grad school. And this wasn't someone I knew really well. They didn't know me, but again, this was what they did. They helped students with these questions. So I made an appointment, went to see them, outlined my dilemma, and said, I don't know what to do. You know, what should I be thinking about in order to figure this out? What should I be looking into? What questions should I be asking myself? And the person, I remember, just looked at me and said, well, I don't think you should go to grad school. And I don't think you should go to law school. And I remember thinking, what? I don't want to go to med school. Like, what is he, you know, talking about? And what they ended up telling me was essentially that they were surprised that I got into a college at all. They were surprised I got into the college I got into, and they didn't think I was cut out for higher ed. So they said, essentially, you should be just happy that you're going to get a bachelor's degree and go get a job somewhere. that was their response. And again, they didn't really know anything about me or my academic background. So I left deflated. And I admit, you know, I was young then. I internalized a little bit of it and started to question myself, like, maybe I'm not cut out. I've never gotten that feedback, but this is what this person does. Like, they're good at what they do. And maybe they're seeing that I'm not cut out for it. You know, and then a couple of days later, I snapped out of it. I got pretty angry about the whole situation and ended up deciding to go into psychology and never looked back. I had an amazing experience in my grad program. I did my internship. I did a couple of fellowships. And then I worked for a couple of organizations and eventually started my clinical practice in, I think, 2005. And I thought that's kind of where it would end, right? Like, I would just do clinical work and clinical psychology and health psychology. But I had always had an interest in business and leadership development and organizational functioning. And I think part of it stemmed from my father. He owned his own business. He was an architect. And so I was kind of interested in those issues. And I had researched executive coaching for years, talked to coaches, taken a couple of seminars, and eventually decided to just obtain some additional training. So eventually became an executive coach in addition to my psychotherapy practice, and then also started doing some consulting with teams and diversity. And that's kind of where I am today. It took a little bit to get there, though.
Wow. Wow. Quite a journey in spite of the barriers that you faced. I mean, just people in a position of power that were evaluating you and supposed to support you explicitly telling you that you shouldn't be going to grad school. And actually, when you were saying that, I felt a burst of anger with that type mm-hmm. of statement. I'm just saying, oh my gosh, who is he to even suggest that?
Absolutely. But I think you and I also both know that this is the kind of thing that happens to a lot of professionals of color in their academics and in their journeys and their careers. This isn't unusual. I think it was probably more direct than what we typically experience, but absolutely a hurdle we all face.
Yeah, yeah. I like you, that you're talking about direct versus indirect. And I think that's a theme that we've also talked about. And a little bit of a disclosure here. My experience with grad school was, or prior to getting into grad school, was I had an academic advisor tell me, well, your grades, they're just not good enough for you to get into grad school. So it was more subtle than it is in your case, which I'm just shocked that this advisor even suggested that. So now you talked about your work in consulting as well as clinical practice. And the message that we're trying to convey here for our listeners and also helping them think more critically about their work to provide an impact to clients of color. We want to talk about microaggressions and the steps to engage clients in these conversations. Can you elaborate more about how might we go about doing that?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question because a lot of these clients or patients are dealing with microaggressions to outright racism. But I think it's also important to be mindful, whether it's a psychotherapy client or an executive coaching client, that not every person of color who presents may have the same views on race and racism. I don't meet that many, but we all know that there are some people who don't believe racism exists. And so to kind of open the door and have them talk about those issues doesn't feel okay to them. And then there's some people who have had really negative experiences in the healthcare system, including therapy, as well as executive coaching, not healthcare, but another, you know, system, and really are not trusting of us to be able to talk about these issues because they've had bad experiences, they've been minimized. So typically when I start thinking about that issue, because, you know, with my experience, it's really important for me to have and create safe environments for other people to be able to talk about this issue, I'll usually wait for an opening. You know, I'll wait for them to say something that maybe could be about racism, then query from there, right? To see if how comfortable they are talking about these issues or how important they feel these issues are in their life. Sometimes I'm a little bit more direct where, you know, someone may share a narrative and I might say something like, you know, that sounds incredibly upsetting, right? I'm so sorry you had to go through that. It seems really unfair. Do you think that that event was racially based, or do you think something else contributed to it? Just to open the door and see if they walk through. And sometimes if I can't find that opening, but I just want to check before we, you know, move forward, I'll just be very direct and say something to the effect of, you know, sometimes psychologists or executive coaches don't always understand the experience of the people we're working with because we come from different backgrounds and have different experiences. And is that something that you worry about in our work together, right? And what I find is that in 95, 97% of the time, most people of color I'm working with sort of look incredibly relieved that I've mentioned this. And usually the floodgates open. They start talking about experiences they've had personally or professionally, encountered different things and experienced racial trauma. Or sometimes they'll talk about previous therapy experiences or coaching experiences where they've tried to talk about these issues, but a bit shut down in different ways. So that's how I typically will broach the topic, just to see if someone is even comfortable or willing to go there.
It sounds like, as you're describing this, a delicate interaction where both you and the client are assessing how safe the environment is to even broach this conversation. You're looking for that window of opportunity or that door to open. The client is also getting a feel of, can I talk about this issue? And the other part I'm wondering about too, because you mentioned some clients may not be aware. How do you navigate that where maybe a client of color isn't aware of racism being an issue for them? Mm-hmm. And as part of our work, taking a social justice lens, how do you navigate that?
You know, that one's a little bit tricky. I will say I don't often encounter those people in either of my practices, so it doesn't come up very often. And when it does, I try to gauge where they're at, right? Because at the end of the day, the work that we do involves kind of meeting people where they're at. And so for some of those patients or coaching clients, they don't want to talk about these issues. They want to strictly talk about other issues, and they kind of draw a line in the sand. And I have to be respectful of that. I have to be respectful of where they're at with these issues and address the issues that they do feel comfortable talking about. Once in a while, even if they've drawn the line in the sand, sometimes some of the issues that they're coming in with do point to racism, and we may dabble a little bit and kind of talk around it or talk about it. And some people will start to kind of realize, oh, wow, maybe it isn't just me, or it isn't just someone's temperament. Maybe there's a structural issue going on. Maybe it's systemic racism. But, you know, you have to really go slow and be respectful. And I do respect once someone draws a line in the sand and says, you know what, I really don't want to talk about race and racism. And we'll explore maybe why, mm-hmm. and then kind of back off and go, you know, go on to the things that they want to come in for. But like I said, that doesn't happen often in my practice, I'll admit.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is also something that you mentioned during our call earlier, and that is, even though it's shocking for me to learn about it, mm-hmm. it's also not a surprise, which is you mentioning that you've actually experienced more racism once you became a professional. So I would imagine mm-hmm. that with these executive clients who are in leadership positions, they're probably being exposed to more of it.
Potentially, yeah. It's really interesting. I mean, I certainly experienced microaggressions and racism growing up. But I would say, you know, after grad school, after internship, after fellowships, as soon as I hit the professional world, the number of incidents sort of skyrocketed. And it was something I talked about a lot with colleagues of color. Many of us felt like fairly early in our careers, we hit, you know, what I call the concrete ceiling, right? Where there were so many barriers, we could only go so far. And, you know, those experiences range. Like, you know, you talked about subtle versus obvious racism. Some of it was obvious, right? Like being confused for waitstaff at a professional conference where I was about to receive an award, right, in half an hour to, I remember when 9/11 happened, a colleague of mine sort of pulled me aside and said, I'm so glad you're working here. You can kind of share why your people do the kinds of things they do, because she knew I had grown up, you know, Muslim, culturally Muslim. And so some of it's obvious stuff, but a lot of it is, you know, really subtle. It's the everyday being in professional spaces and balancing being hyper-visible and yet invisible at the same time, being ignored because you're a person of color, or having your expertise invalidated because of your person of color. And yet a white colleague may say the exact same thing a few minutes later and it's applauded, right? So all of that is constant for a lot of people of color in their personal and professional circles. And I think that's why it's important for me to create spaces for psychotherapy clients and coaching clients to be able to explore those issues, because they're draining. They're draining. And, you know, even though psychotherapy and executive coaching are really different, the one thing that my patients of color and my coaching clients of color have in common is that when they're talking about these issues, most of them talk about consistently fatigue and frustration, which I refer to as F squared, right? They talk a lot about fatigue and frustration. And, you know, a lot of that fatigue is dealing with daily microaggressions or dealing with racism, being mindful of inequities in pay or promotions or treatment, right? Going into work, kind of feeling like you have to put armor on to kind of guard against those microaggressions. Some people code switching to try to fit in better into their environment, working harder than usual. You know, all these things cause an incredible amount of exhaustion that both my patients and clients will often express. And then just plain frustration, knowing that you're going to have to deal with this and there is no end in sight, right? Until systemic racism is dismantled, which isn't happening in my lifetime, you know, and it's unlikely to happen in my child's lifetime. And, you know, the frustration of also knowing that even though we're talking about diversity more, especially since 2020, with the murders of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and countless others, the needle really hasn't moved that much. Mm-hmm. And so there's the frustration around when is it going to change, and knowing that it's going to be in there, a constant in their world indefinitely.
Yeah. It's an ongoing battle. Mm-hmm. People are trying to erase history right now.
Absolutely.
Can't talk about, and the way they're talking about slavery, it's just appalling. In your work with the clients in private practice as well as executive coaching, so for our listeners who are therapists, faculty members, or who are also doing executive coaching themselves, mm-hmm. do you have any tips or strategies for them in terms of addressing microaggressions with your clients, either drawing them out, or is there a message you'd like to convey that might be helpful for them?
I think for me, one of the best things to be thinking about if you're working with people of color in those contexts that you just said is kind of zooming out and doing some work yourself first, before trying to work with patients or clients, or if you're working with students, right, in grad programs or undergrad. And I think two tips that I would say in particular that are really critical is, one is do the learning, right? Both the external learning and the internal learning. And secondly, get used to speaking the quote unquote language, right? And so starting with the learning, I think that the external and internal learning is really critical. The external learning means go ahead and educate yourself about systemic racism and how it plays out. Educate yourself about your client's background. You know, there's some great ways to do it. You know, this podcast, right? Other podcasts, seminars, conferences, you know, the big thing is not to simply rely on your patient or client to teach you. It's convenient, but it's sort of intellectually lazy, right? Because the client isn't necessarily an expert, right? I'm a woman, but you wouldn't ask me to serve on a panel to talk and be an expert on feminism necessarily, right? So do your own learning externally and do the internal work of learning. So, you know, understand your own role with respect to racism. You know, we all have privilege and power in certain ways. Be mindful of where your privilege and power lies and how it impacts how people treat you and how it impacts how other people are treated as well. You know, I think a lot of times we think of ourselves as being pro-DEI. We think of ourselves as allies, but we're not always doing the ongoing work of looking at how we may be contributing to the isms, right, through our own biases. So it's important to understand those and not just organize DEI events and go to marches, but to really speak out every day when you see those inequities playing out in your workplace or what have you, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the other piece is speak the language. And this is really critical. And what I mean by that is, you know, I grew up in a family where we talked about race and isms. I talk about it a lot more in my family, you know, that I've created. But as a result of doing that as a kid, you know, when I hit college, when I hit grad school, you know, and my grad school had a huge, huge emphasis on diversity and exploring our biases, and our professors were in there with us doing the same thing. It was relatively easy for me to talk about inequity and racism or anti-LGBTQ issues because I talked about it so often. And for a lot of patients and for a lot of coaching clients, if they're wanting to talk about these issues and you're someone who doesn't talk about these issues every day or every week, they'll pick up on it right away. And that signals to them, right or wrong, that maybe you really can't support them in your journey because you may not be as aware and you're not talking about these issues yourselves. So I think the learning is a critical piece, as well as speaking the language is something I would recommend to all practitioners, really.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for clarifying that or providing such a great example of speaking the language, because I was actually curious about that. Mm-hmm. Which is it a terminology thing? Is it more I'm signaling I am talking about the importance of, for instance, equity issues for women in the workplace? I mean, are we even able to bring that up, you know?
Right, right. Yeah. So I think it's all of it. Are we able to bring it up with ease? Are we using terminology that isn't offensive and outdated, right? And as I just mentioned a second ago, are we talking about things with ease, or are we stumbling and stuttering in ways we normally might not if we were discussing something else? All those things tell a patient or a client a lot about you and sort of where you are in your journey. Because if you're not that far along in your journey, it's going to be really difficult to support them around those issues. And they pick up on those things really quickly, as you know.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's really incredible as you're describing this path, this journey experience, because I can tell you that this is a journey I'm taking on my own. I'm having to unlearn. I'm making mistakes. I acknowledge that as a human being. Mm-hmm. And so there are certain terminologies I'm still wrestling with. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that I'm not interested in mm-hmm. learning. It's just, how frequently am I using the terminology? How often am I describing these ideas? So I like that you're painting that landscape as people are thinking about this work.
Mm-hmm. And I love that you brought that up, because the reality is it doesn't matter who you are. Like, we're always in process learning these issues, right? I remember going to do a talk about something related to diversity, and someone there didn't realize I was there to do the talk, right? I just kind of blended in. And they were like, oh, didn't we have a talk on this 6 months ago? Like, how much information do we need? And I remember turning to them, and at the time I was this was about 5-6 years ago, I remember saying, well, you know, I'm a DEI expert. I've been doing this work at the time for about 15 years, and I'm still learning new things every single year, right? Because we're always in process when it comes to these issues, and that's perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as we're talking about learning, right, growth, was there one thing you learned that you didn't expect?
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about that. I mean, I think for me, what was surprising is for whatever reason, even when I was young, I always keyed into these issues of inequity. I had taken this phenomenal class in college, Psychology of Oppression, with Dr. Erinette White, who was just amazing. And as I mentioned, my grad program at the time infused diversity into everything, and really not only the external stuff, but the internal stuff, looking at ourselves, processing our own biases, professors talking about their own biases. I mean, it was just in our classes and supervision and our dissertation, it was all of it. And it was of interest to me, but I don't know that I realized how much that, even though all my work is not DEI related, right? It's still interesting to me and surprising to me how much of a natural lens from which I, you know, view the world is DEI based. And ultimately, it did become important for me to be able to work with professionals of color in coaching and people of color in psychotherapy to create a safe space for them. I don't know that I had anticipated that so much of my work would be DEI focused, but it is weaved in there to varying degrees, you know, for sure, for sure.
Mm. So it sounds like you had really supportive graduate training program that is in some ways, I would say, atypical to at least some of the guest speakers I've had on the show. Oh gosh, some of their experiences, it's just baffling.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, it wasn't perfect, of course, but, you know, when I talked with colleagues from all over the country and we were talking about these issues within the context of our program was incredibly supportive. And we even had a group for students of color in psychology, right, where we talked about these issues. It was for grad students. But again, the professors were kind of rolling up their sleeves and doing the messy work of looking at ourselves as well. And that ended up being critical for my development as a psychologist, but also being able to talk about these issues. And, you know, how often do you get a space to do that in grad school, right?
Yeah. It's like having a space to truly look at the human experience and appreciating and honoring that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And looking at yourself, including, you know, the good, bad, the neutral.
Yeah. May I ask, the professors, are they white?
Most of them were white.
Wow.
I'm trying to think. So we had one professor who was Native American, but the rest of them were white. They were committed. And like I said, it wasn't perfect, but they were really committed. And the program still continues. I'm well out. I won't tell you how long I've been out, but they still continue to be really committed. And I think what allowed for that is for those professors to also admit how much they didn't know and continue to explore and do their own internal work. That's, I think, what allowed for the program to be so strong when it came to issues of isms and diversity.
Right. Wow. Now, as a person of color, and you already spoke to the challenges faced, such as the racist acts against you and your family, even at such an early age, how are you navigating the challenges of racism?
It taught me a lot about how to navigate these issues a little bit differently, because I learned and I got older. And so, you know, I'm not going to say that racism doesn't affect me. It impacts me every single day. Even though I'm not employed by anyone, I'm self-employed, I still have to interact with people from different walks of life and organizations. But I think I feel stronger around how to handle these issues as they come up. And as I get older, for better or for worse, I have a little less patience and I'm more likely to speak right up and get my message across. So sometimes, you know, of course that can backfire, but for me, it's worth it.
Yeah,
it's needed. And for me, it's worth it. It's worth it. And I also have learned how to cultivate allies so that I'm not the only one speaking up. And I've also learned when to pick and choose my battles. So, yeah.
So do you have any other final thoughts or messages you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, the reality is the impact of racism or any ism is pretty persistent and pervasive. And it has real implications on the people we work with, not only in terms of their mental health, but their medical health, their careers, everything. And so it's important that if you're working with people of color to really do the deep work and the internal work before you start doling out, you know, advice or support or things like that, because a lot of people who don't do that internal work can often misstep and really do damage, more damage than good in their, with their patients or their clients. So that would be my advice, is really, really do the internal work, knowing that, of course, it's going to be ongoing. Like I said before, we're all in process.
Yeah. And Dr. Samji, is there anything we can do to support you?
Yeah, no, people can look me up on LinkedIn. They can go to my website, which is somjicc.com. And if anyone has any questions or thoughts, I'm always open to getting feedback. Contact me via LinkedIn.
Okay. All right. And Dr. Samji, thank you very much for everything you shared on our podcast today. Any other final thoughts?
No, just thank you for having me. And I really appreciate this podcast and what you're doing.
I hope you liked this episode. Please subscribe and share. We love to hear from you. So send me a message on LinkedIn or email. The People of Color in Psychology is brought to you by the Multicultural Counseling Institute, and I'm your host, Jack Tsen.